I got the news.
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
I was a working journalist, a hired geek of sorts.
He calls you the Jay Leno of news anchors. You're popular because you don't bother anyone.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Jealous of the size of Jay's audience.
I don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter.
Oh, we got some reporters for you. It's Friday. Time to talk about the week's news on the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Steve Scheer in a special Studio B with an audience of donors. Hello, donors.
Hi there. How you doing?
Also with us, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times. Good to see you back.
Good morning.
C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Good to see you, sir.
Good morning.
And Knut Berger, Mossback columnist at crosscut.com, blogging at Seattle Magazine. Sir?
Hey.
It's good to see you all. This was a good week for Seattle, right? Because Microsoft and Amazon were very happy to report good earnings and growth.
I would say Boeing was also.
And Boeing was happy this morning, too, weren't they? Even selling a 747, I think I heard.
And what about the Twitter trending that we've established here in Seattle?
Yeah. Do you have a Twitter trend that you're going to start us with today?
Well, not today, but next week for sure.
So the report was on the cover of the Times. It was a report that came out that said Seattle is number one for trends in Twitters, for the hashtag trends in Twitters.
We're not bragging about that, are we?
We are indeed.
I think they were.
We are indeed.
I can cheeseburger, Knut. I can Mossback. You know, I think you now have. I think we have.
You're
a
doing my marketing for me.
I can hashtag. All right, let's talk about some of the issues. Let's start with one nearby because it's an interesting story. So a national attention coming into the SeaTac $15 an hour minimum wage proposition that's on the ballot for SeaTac voters only. But a lot of national attention coming to it and a lot of national money coming to it. Have you been covering it, Sarah?
Absolutely.
What strikes you about that debate?
Well, what strikes me is how broad the measure is. I mean, it's $15 minimum wage. It's a paid sick leave provision. It's also got a complicated part of the initiative that talks about retaining workers if a new buyer, you know, comes in and buys, a hotel or restaurant or something. So it's not just a minimum wage measure. But as you say, there's a ton of money on both sides. Labor is pushing this. They tried for years to get the port to up the wages. They didn't. So they've gone kind of the next best route, which is an initiative of the people. I suspect it'll win. And if it does, you're going to have a lot of reverberations because though SeaTac is a town of, 25,000 people, very, very small in the scheme of things when you're talking about the Puget Sound, this will have reverberations. I mean, you're very likely next year to see a measure on the Seattle ballot, especially if this wins.
It's an interesting argument that the folks supporting it are making because they're arguing that the port as a public entity should pay higher wages, even though they're not directly targeting the port itself.
Yes, and much of the opposition is coming from the individual businesses there that are sort of trapped, if you think about it, because you take, some of the opposition has come from Ivar's president, and you think about the fact that they're not supposed to charge anything different at the airport than they do at their other outlets. So how are they supposed to make up for that? But CR is correct that there's so much attention on this because the minimum wage, the rallies were nationwide. They were in many, many, many cities. And, people are wondering, is this one of those issues that can really capture the public's imagination and take off? It felt a little bit to me this year like it was a mini Occupy kind of movement, a little bit like that it had that sense to it. And that, it happens in the fall and then the winter comes and the rains come. But this is on the ballot, so this one may or may not have legs.
Occupy SeaTac.
I think this is part of a larger trend, which is that people don't expect the national government to be able to accomplish much. And so local entities are starting to operate more on what's kind of called the city-state basis, which is that America is a collection of city-states. And one of those city-states is Seattle/Puget Sound. And we have certain values about how we want to do business here, how we want to prosper. And you know, the idea of national minimum wages, raising that is just going to go nowhere, so that you can vote on these things or legislate these things on a very local level as a way of saying, this is how we want to do business here. And we're going through, we're coming out of the recession, we're going through, as you were saying earlier, a period of where we can see prosperity ahead. And I think there's a sense that that prosperity should be shared in a more equitable way. If it can happen nationally, it can happen here. And I think that's part of the impetus behind these votes, regardless of what the details are, some of which could be very difficult for businesses to deal with.
So I went down to SeaTac Airport along with producer Jason Pagano, talking to some folks about Proposition 1 pro and con. And here's Roxanne Seibel, who's worked at a store in the airport for 30 years.
The jobs here, everybody keeps saying that they're entry-level jobs, but let me tell you, when you're trying to support a family, and most of the people that work here do, and what is expected of us, it's fair.
She told me that after 30 years, she was making about $13 an hour and got health care only because she was unionized. And speaking of Ivers, we also talked to Ivers president Bob Donegan.
Our primary concern is that this has become a mechanism for organizing the workforces down here without a union election. So normally bargaining occurs between a union and the employees and an employer. This one obviates all those needs.
It is interesting that the unions are working through municipal government to try to get this passed.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things about this debate that I've observed is it's sort of also a debate about at what point in your life do you take these jobs? Do you take these jobs early on and then you expect, you know, to get a minimum wage because it's a starting position? Or do they become, as this woman has written, you know, your lifetime occupation, and then you are living on it as if you were a younger person, but now, you know, you have three kids and you have been trying to live on this for the whole time. And I noticed in the piece that Roxanne wrote
in Crosscut
that she was talking about exactly that point, about how that this is her occupation. She took issue with a colleague of mine, Lynn Varner, for saying it's really about education. You know, folks should be getting college education so they don't take these jobs, or they only take them at the beginning of their work life. But in this case, she's arguing rather feistily about the fact that this is her job for 30 years. She has a family. She has these, you know, understandable expenses that make it very, very difficult to live on that amount of money.
But we should say she's not living on minimum wage. I mean, she was making $13.50 an hour, so she would benefit from this. Of course, it went to $15, but it's not as though she's at $9. I mean, after 30 years, she's not making as much as she should, but. But the people who this would apply to are
right.
Mostly the first timers. One thing that's interesting about this politically is that there are about 5,000 people that will probably vote in SeaTac on this measure, maybe 4. This is a huge, huge deal and will have reverberations, as I said. But when you talk about the number of people that actually will be voting on this, and interestingly enough, only 1 in 4 of the workers, 1 in 10, I think the number is, very small percentage of the workers that would actually benefit from this even live in SeaTac. I mean, most of the people that work at the airport, most of the people that work in these hotels actually are from places like Seattle or Federal Way. I mean, so it's an interesting dynamic that way.
But because it's such a small number of people who will actually cast a vote, the stories all went into this in detail. You can actually knock on those doors so many times to try to get your message across, and both sides are certainly doing that. But one other interesting thing about this is that Adam Smith, the congressman, got into this. You know, it's a very local thing. He doesn't have to say a word about it, but he did. He came out in favor of the measure because his argument was that his father had worked at the airport. And at that time, it was a living wage and could raise a family and have a son who could maybe go on to Congress or but that today the number has held down so much that it doesn't really translate in the same way.
I just do want to say that Bob Donegan at Ivers was proud that they were offering a wage of 13 something for most of their starting workers, and they do see that they are creating a path going forward. But some of the people are arguing against this by saying, well, these are jobs for entry-level workers or high school students. And many people are saying that's just not how the economy works anymore anywhere. SeaTac, Seattle, Puget Sound.
Well, yeah. As you can see, those jobs are often for single mothers with four kids. You know, it's not the sort of baby boomer job market of the 60s. I thought Donegan made an interesting point, too, about the unionization being a big part of the picture, which is that as some of these types of, like the Seattle's family leave and whatnot, get passed, they actually are creating incentives for employees to unionize, for companies to use, because they get exempt from some of the provisions of the laws. And so it actually becomes almost cheaper for them to go union because they can take advantage of some of the loopholes. So that's part of the bigger picture, the sort of national picture of these laws, if they pass, giving leverage.
Yeah, and they have, of course, had some success in other airports raising the wages or challenging the wages that are paid there. I mean, this is about a shift that's right to the core of what we've been talking about. What's affordable and what's fair? What's living wage? Seattle tried to take this up, and they probably will again if this succeeds.
I do. I believe there'll be a Seattle measure, I think, as early as next year. I mean, listen, the minimum wage is going to go up. I mean, Washington's minimum wage is indexed to inflation, so every year it does go up a bit. It's at $9.19 or something now. So over time, the minimum wage does not go down, right? It goes up. But this is, I think the debate here is about the extent of the increase. Because when you're going from sort of $9.19 to $15, what, it's a 63% increase, something like that. I mean, there are a lot of people who are sort of supportive of better pay, but would like to do this incrementally. And, you know, that's part of kind of what's going on here.
The other fact is that Washington has the highest minimum wage in the country, although California recently decided to raise theirs, and it will go up and exceed over time. It has an escalator on it. It will go up and exceed Washington's over time.
Who built that escalator? Guys, minimum wage workers. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about what's happening nationally and then back again to what's happening in the mayor's race in Seattle, some other issues, including your nominations for future monuments. Joni Balter, Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas in Studio B with us with KUOW donor audience. This is The Week in Review on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
It's 10:19. Have you signed up for or tried to sign up for health care under the Affordable Care Act? If so, we want to hear your story. How'd it go? Did you have problems or was it smooth sailing? Let us know by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. And thanks for making that connection.
Support for KUOW comes from World Vision, striving to bring lasting change to children in need through clean water, health, education, and more. Learn more at worldvision.org. World Vision believes in children.
It's 50 degrees in Seattle with a predicted high today of 53. It looks like a certain amount of clouds and fog through the day with a continuing chance of light rain. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20.
94.9 KUOW Seattle. It's the Week in Review for Friday. I'm Steve Scher. C.R. Douglas is here from Q13 Fox. Joni Balter is here from the Seattle Times. C.R. and Knute Berger is, I'm making you here twice. And Knute Berger is here as Mossback at crosscut.com and author of Pugetopolis and many other things. We're going to stack all your books here one day. I want to look at a couple of national stories. Oh, and by the way, we're in Studio B with the with an audience of KUOW donors. I meant to welcome you guys again. Live radio, we get confused.
Try live TV.
Oh, I can imagine. Do you have people in your ear all the time telling you what to say?
Yes, yes.
Do you like that?
It has its moments, but it's mostly hard, mostly frustrating.
I was going to see if you said something like very politic because the
people they can hear you.
Yeah.
That's right.
So a lot of national stories came out this week, and one of them, just to refute, our editor Phyllis Fletcher looked into this. The claim repeated in some national stories that you cannot window shop for healthcare coverage at healthcare.gov. That's false. The problem was false. The problem was solved by October 11th, and Phyllis tested it, and he's right. It works now. In this case, what comes up, and you can see what's going on, and if people do have problems with that website still, we want to know about it. And we've been sort of tracking the problems in our own website in the preceding days, and we'll keep tracking that as well. So, but nationally, what did you make of how it has unfolded with the president and then with Congress? So the president came out, he said, yeah, it was no good, it's terrible, and it wasn't his fault.
Well, Obama had to come out and say what he said, is that I'm not going to sugarcoat this. This website's really troubled. But it was kind of funny to watch. I was at this gym, and it only got Fox TV, and it didn't have any sound. And so all I could see was that, you know, Obama looking fairly unhappy, and then just continual references to the website says, this site is shut down, this site doesn't work, please wait, you know, all this kind of thing. But you know, what I was taking from this was that whole shutdown. Remember that just a few minutes ago, that it obscured the story that maybe the Republicans really wanted, which was how much trouble the website was having. It sort of pushed it down as the top story. And so this week that became the top story, that the only thing that some of the different TV stations were talking about was A, the website really is troubled. They have to bring in troubleshooters. ACE people are coming in. Maybe they'll rebuild it or something like that. But Obama also did have a pretty good answer, which is, do you want the health care? Do you want, you know, to be assured that a pre-existing condition won't plague you? Do you want some of the features of it? Well, then give me a minute here to fix this thing. And he said, you know, the person that's most upset with this is him, and so therefore it shall be fixed. Now, he did not give a date as to when it might be fixed. He did do one hokey thing that I thought was weird. He kept giving out the phone number to call. People are standing by. And I couldn't help but think of sort of late night TV when they're telling you this number over and over again. It didn't seem that presidential to me. I'm sorry.
I'm like Barack Obama.
I was thinking the Ronco guy, you know. Yeah.
The Ron Popeil of health insurance.
Click it and 1-800. Forget it.
You know, I was trying to – well, go ahead, and then I'll ask you.
Well, it couldn't come at a better time for Republicans. Listen, they were – you know, couldn't have gotten lower in the approval ratings after the shutdown and the flirting with the debt default. So this comes at a great time for them. They love this issue better than Benghazi. It's everything they had hoped for in an issue, right? I mean, it's Obamacare, which they've hated and which they're united on. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement over spending and other things in the Republican ranks, but there's no disagreement over Obamacare, basically. So this allows them to pile on kind of in unison. And, you know, it's working. But a website is correctable. And I think this will get corrected. But probably not fast enough for them to have to make some changes. And you already have Democrats, loyal Democrats, talking about that things need to be extended. The enrollment period, I mean, perhaps the individual mandate, but fines may be extended, that kind of thing. I mean, Democrats are ducking for cover on this because
that's strong. You think they're ducking for cover?
I do. I believe they feel very let down by the president here. This was a huge, important signature achievement of his administration. They all got behind it, and now it's kind of, you know, it's falling apart a bit. It will get back together, but yes, it is a political it's a political hit for the president.
By the way, does anybody remember that the first couple of years of the New Deal were a fiasco? No. We remember what the New Deal did for this country. But Roosevelt was under tremendous criticism, including from his own party, because some of the programs that they implemented were dumb or didn't work. And I think that the thing – it's not to say that the computer website issue is not a problem. I think what you're seeing here this last week is the media, you know, as predictable as a herd of cattle – They've been beating up on the Republicans, rightly so, because of the shutdown. Now they have a chance to beat up on Obama to make themselves look objective and miss the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that the nobody liked the healthcare system that we have. And the demand for the kinds of improvements that Obamacare will bring are going to make this successful in the long term. Because people do want to be able to get insurance if they have pre-existing conditions. They do want a system that will eventually control prices. So it's not like, you know, the Republicans might, criticize the implementation, and there's lots of room for criticism. But Obama has said from the very beginning that he wanted that adjustments would need to be made to the program, and that's obvious. And I think that the need that it fulfills is the market desire for something better, I think, is so strong it will overcome these glitches.
Well, we saw that. We saw that in the responses people had. That's one of the reasons the websites were collapsed, because they were swamped.
It all depends on what happens next. You know, one thing we learn is attention span is pretty short around here. You know, so maybe 8 weeks ago, all we could talk about was Syria. Syria? What's going on with Syria? No one's talking about it.
I have that on my news agenda for 2 weeks from now.
Uh-huh. I know you do. But the question is simply, you know, what happens next? And what I mean by that is if things smooth out, then this will be like what you said, Skip. It'll be long forgotten. You'll remember, healthcare didn't have a rocky start, but yeah, now I have my healthcare by the time you're actually supposed to be on the healthcare.
Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking it's better than Benghazi. Benghazi is the commercial that will follow the "I'm Barack Obama" give a call to this number.
I do think over time it's going to be worked out. Like I said, I mean, website glitches can be fixed, and it will be ultimately judged by, does Obamacare lower, you know, insurance costs? Is it easier to get? Is there enough people in the pool? I mean, do you feel like you have the coverage?
But initially, it'd be judged by, am I covered? I mean, that's who they're really targeting in the next few months, even next couple of years. Don't you think?
Meaning, like, will it be judged by how many people sign up?
Well, and all the people who couldn't get coverage are now getting coverage. Will there be 35 million people who are now in the system, as opposed to working out the kinks of what is a Rube Goldberg contraption of a health insurance market?
Right. Right. I mean, I do think I agree. The uninsured being insured, the sort of movement there will be one way to judge. But I do also think people who have existing health care, what happens to their premiums, and is that affected by Obamacare? I mean, 85% of the people in the country have some kind of health care now. They're not going to these exchanges. They don't need them. So Obamacare is affecting those people. A lot of it good, but that could be down the road problematic if prices go up for the people already covered.
Well, in some ways, it'll be a war of anecdotes. You'll hear anecdotes on both sides, and they'll be, you know, good and bad, of course. But also what is most likely to happen here is that there will be state-by-state results. So some states, and Washington is expected to be in the top 10 because we already had exchanges and our insurance person was really into the implementation of Obamacare. So some states will have more success stories. You'll find out, oh, I went in and it was a lower price. But there will be some states, especially some of the states that resisted setting up the exchanges, where the anecdotes are not going to be that positive. So it's not going to be a clean, it worked or it didn't work. It's going to be state by state, is my guess.
Well, it will be anecdotal, and you're already seeing that. There was a woman on Fox this week who was complaining that her insurance had been canceled because of Obamacare, and she was all in a Twitter about that. And, but the fact is she had not looked to see whether her insurance company was offering options on the exchanges. She did not look to see whether there were equal programs or equivalent programs or even cheaper programs as part of the option. So people, you know, you might get some sticker shock when your insurance company says it's making a change. That happened to me with Group Health. I got a thing from Group Health saying we're switching all our policies because of the Affordable Health Care Act. But then when you went on to the exchange, you found there were insurance programs that were just as good, some cheaper, some more expensive, and you had a whole bunch of options that you didn't have before. Or you can just stay with Group Health and go with whatever their new plan is. So I'm just saying that it is the kind of thing that lends itself to these kind of shock anecdotes of people's reactions. That's just sort of the worst journalism that focuses on that, although that's where the good quotes are.
And some of the features of the Health Care Act will just plain be popular. Keeping kids on their parents' insurance till 26 is something that's likely to be popular. And not having to worry about pre-existing conditions, the donut hole, there's some things in there that if you pull them out, you know, the Affordable Health Care Act doesn't poll test very high, but if you pull different features out and just ask people about very specific things, there are some features that people are going to be very reluctant to let go if there was ever an attempt to repeal it.
Just before I shift, just this question of Democrats running for cover. We also saw some Democrats, we heard in that cut at the top of the hour, not liking the kind of hearings that the Republicans were holding. I'd like to see a silver lining. There is, of course, many improvements to be made. Anything you've heard, anything you've read, where there will actually be a coming together to try to improve some of the glitches in this plan. Have you heard or seen anything that's, you know, actual moving forward, easing the donut hole, these others?
Well, the only thing that seemed like it was going to be was the tax on medical devices, which they were going to use to end the shutdown, and they ended up not using that. And that one, the reason why that might have been part of that agreement was that nobody really cared that much about it either way. I mean, it is part of the total money coming in to finance it, but apparently it's not that big a deal. So that was one where there seemed to be, like, imagine this, common ground.
All right, a couple other national stories, then we'll move on. Chris Christie dropping his opposition to gay marriage. What was that about, other than an obvious no-brainer for somebody
that's
who's
about
in elected office?
His state was polling just the opposite of where he was on that he was losing in the courts, that he had nowhere else to go. He was out of gas on that one.
Does it hurt him nationally in 2016 for the Republicans?
It doesn't hurt him in New Jersey. In fact, it helps him in New Jersey. Basically, as Johnny says, the Supreme Court in New Jersey basically said we're allowing this in the state. So he had no choice but just sort of back off and say the court has spoken. To quit fighting it will help him in New Jersey. It will not help him if he runs for president in 2016. Obviously, you know, it's a pretty conservative primary electorate when you talk about Republicans. However, he's already damaged goods in the mind of many hardcore Republicans. This is never going to be a Tea Party, you know, figurehead. This guy is already looks too moderate. So my guess is that allowing a court action to give gay marriage to a state, which is different than signing into law, is probably not going to hurt him any more than he's already hurt by having, you know, embraced Obama after Hurricane Sandy.
You're right. Chris Christie, how is he going to get through a Republican primary with some of the things that he's already done? What about the hug? The hug of Obama.
What about the hug?
Well, and those things that often make an Atlantic state's moderate or mainstream Republican attractive to the rest of the country repel the rest of the Republican Party. And so whether you're, you know, Giuliani or even Mitt Romney, who had to then completely denounce the program he'd pioneered in Massachusetts in health care. And I don't think Chris Christie is the kind of personality who will denounce something that he did in that same way. I don't think Chris Christie, whatever you think of him, I don't think he's a two-face, and at least not more than many politicians. So anyway, I don't think it'll help him with his party, but it certainly helps his standing, I think, in general.
Well, one thing I'd say, I mean, just because this isn't going to endear him to the Tea Party doesn't mean I believe that he's suddenly a non-player in 2016. I mean, I do think, first of all, I think the gay marriage thing is moving so quickly that by 2016, it may not be a thing that's held against you, even in the Republican primary. And that if the Republicans in Congress continue to have low approval, that the person, the guy or girl who comes from outside of Washington, who shows some success in a state, will be teed up in a better position. And that there may be such desire to win this thing back that they'll look to a Christie and hold their nose, some of the more conservative, to get him to win the nomination. Still a long shot, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Or he could threaten to run as an independent. and get their attention that way.
Gay married tea partiers holding up signs at rallies saying, get the government government's hands off my health insurance. That's 2016. I let Jon Stewart watch much of my Fox News because it's easier for me. And he had a wonderful series of clips from Fox News where Karl Rove and a number of other people were saying, well, I'm going to paraphrase Stewart now. We got to get the genie back in the bottle and get control over this Republican Party. And Karl Rove is even launching a new effort to get different kinds of candidates into the general election.
He did so well last time.
Well, circling the wagons of the Republican Party?
The Republicans have been trying to figure out their next move since last November. And there's been much hand-wringing, and there's been much discussion about how to reach out to younger voters and minority voters. And that will continue for the, you know, nonstop as this party tries to figure out what kind of candidates it wants to present, what kind of policies it wants to get behind. You know, there's everything from the farm bill to immigration to everything, which everyone's watching. They had a rough couple of weeks here with the shutdown. And so that followed the election last year. There's much hand-wringing to be done.
And they've had a rough couple of election cycles with more conservative candidates going down to defeat because they beat more moderates in the primary. So Karl Rove is trying to end the sort of getting primaried phenomenon in the Republican Party because that has lost them, you know, seats in the Senate and seats in the House, and very likely will continue to until they are able to prop up their sort of more moderates and not let them lose a primary.
Every time a noun becomes a verb, I just have to watch. Primaried?
Yeah, that's right. That's a whole new class that may be brought into fore. You know, by the way, just as we leave the federal issues, furloughed federal workers in Washington State, they're going to have to repay their unemployment benefits that they got during the 16-day shutdown because the Congress included that in the deal, included their back pay in the deal. That's also happening in Illinois and I think in Idaho as well. In Oregon, they get to keep it.
Oregon's the only state they get to keep it. They have some unemployment law there that says they get to keep it, which is weird, right?
We are reviewing the news of the week in Studio B with an audience of KUOW donors with C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, Joni Balter. This is KUOW.
It's election season, and your ballot needs to be returned by November 5th. The Seattle mayor's race is heating up. Plus, there are initiatives about genetically modified food labeling, a $15 an hour minimum wage, and public campaign financing, just to name a few of the contests. If you're not sure how to vote, you can see KUOW's election stories at KUOW.org. And join us every day to hear KUOW's comprehensive election coverage.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Robinson Center for Young Scholars, offering advanced learning programs for elementary through high school students with Saturday enrichment classes, summer courses, and early entrance to the University of Washington. Details on schedule information sessions at the Robinson Center on the UW website.
It's cloudy and foggy in Seattle. No big surprise there. Currently 50 degrees, expecting to reach 53 this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1040.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Steve Scher with Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, Studio B, and an audience of KUOW donors. Give yourself an applause. Yeah. Applause. People who helped end our fund drive on time and healthy. Thank you very much for that. Much appreciated. The McGinn-Murray race. We saw the final TV debate, and then we saw them sculpted in butter, and then we saw a Cairo poll giving us a tighter race, and John Carlson in Crosscut, I believe, who ran for governor and has been a conservative commentator, says it's over. So in backwards order, is it over?
I don't think so. I think the polls have been, there's the Cairo poll is an outlier showing the race at what, 4 or 5 points, very, very narrow. Most of the polls show a much wider gap. There are flaws with all of the polls. And I think that, you know, McGinn has a track record of sort of being a comeback kid. I think that he has a great field operation, and he's a very good campaigner, I think. So I wouldn't count him out. However, I still think it's Murray's to lose. I think the polling does show that Murray has had a lead. I don't know how big it is, but fairly consistent. And he's put together a lot of coalitions and whatnot, which is how he says he will govern to get support for his campaign. So I think he's ahead, but I wouldn't count McGinn out.
Very dangerous to call a race, you know, this many weeks before the ballots are in. The polls are, they're swinging. The polls are, you know, there's two or three polls that show a 20-point race. There's some internal polling that shows more single digits, 8-9%. There was the Cairo poll that had 4%. It's probably closer than the 20 points. There's some, as you said, some flaws with the polls, because they you know, pollsters don't like to spend money on the cell phone only. I've talked about this a lot, but cell phone only voters in a city like Seattle, that's going to be a pretty high number. I actually don't know the number, but I know that years ago, the average nationwide was something like 22%. So in a place like Seattle, it's got to be higher. A lot of those younger voters are McGinn voters, but some of them are Ed Murray voters too. So the best thing to do is wait, obviously, for the election. Everybody knows that. It's not like Mike McGinn has had some great weeks here, though. These are sort of like small punches that are going back and forth between the two. This fight over whether eliminating the Office of Domestic Violence actually led to an increase in domestic violence. The case hasn't really been made there. And at that debate, McGinn seemed to chastise Ed Murray for that. And then Ed Murray even said that the link itself was unfortunate. You know, we just simply don't know. It looks to me like a single digit kind of number between the two, if I had to guess.
I mean, I think, you know, Murray is comfortably ahead, and I'm with Knut that, and probably with Joni too, which is that, you know, it's probably his to lose. But McGinn was supposed to lose the last three elections. He was supposed to lose the 2009 primary. He was supposed to lose the 2009 general, and he was supposed to not place in the 2013 primary. So he does have this way of exceeding expectations. It's been a very bad couple weeks for McGinn. I mean, look, at his fundraising hasn't matched Murray's. These polls have been bad for him. Look at the endorsements that have gone Murray's way. I mean, Steinbrook, Urquhart, the King County Sheriff, Terry Kimball, this, she's not a household name, but this domestic violence person in the McGinn administration basically, you know, comes out against him in this big ad. I wouldn't say Jenny Durkin has endorsed Murray, but I would say the U.S. attorney, you know, almost did this week. So it's hard to find any good news for McGinn in the last couple weeks. And the last debate they had on KCTS, a few nights ago, I thought exemplified where the campaign's at. I think Ed Murray, who did not start very well as a campaigner, certainly last spring, has gotten progressively better over the season. I thought it was his best performance the other night in Channel 9. And I thought McGinn, who actually started strong in the debate season, has sort of slightly weakened. He's gotten sort of worse as I've seen him over the course of the campaign. I think partly his energy level is down. And I thought he didn't do very well on Channel 9 the other night. So you can get away with sort of not doing well if this is August, but that was a key debate at a time when, you know, ballots have dropped and people are now paying attention.
I think Joni made a good point, which is that nothing has really happened to change the discussion about the race. I mean, I went down to the Dairy Gold freezer and saw the life-size butter sculptures of each candidate. They were livelier than the actual candidates. I think one of the things is that Murray has wanted this race to be a referendum on McGinn. He has wanted the race to be essentially, do you like McGinn or not? And counting on the fact that the mayor has very low popularity ratings, and that will be. McGinn has tried to make the race about Murray's record in Olympia. And, you know, in an effort to find somebody who or some entity that's done a worse job than he has, do you like the way Olympia functions? Well, then you'll like Senator Ed Murray. And I don't think that has – I think he's raised good issues, but I don't think that's resonated with voters. And when I talk to people around dinner table, even people who are really – maybe especially people who are really into politics, I'm amazed at how many people are undecided about this race. And I think there's still time – to for McGinn to make a last minute surge, and it looks like he'll need one. I'm not sure he's going to make it, but I think there's time, because I think there are a lot of people out there that they just don't know yet.
Polls work two ways. In one way, they make you think, well, if everybody else is voting that way, I might as well vote that way too, and these people must know something I don't know perhaps, so I'll go along with the polling. But the other thing that polls do is they make your supporters complacent. They don't figure they need to, you know, that thing on the dining room table that maybe you could mail in or maybe not. You're not so worried about it anymore. You're not calling people and telling them that you want them to vote a certain way because you figure it's all over. I thought it was interesting, and I adore John Carlson, that he said it would be 40% for Mike McGinn. Less than 40%, I think he said.
Oh, yeah.
And John Carlson, love him. But when he ran for governor, he knows what 40% looks like.
All right, so
he's the king of 40%.
I was just going to say, if I were Mike McGinn, I'd tape that John Carlson column to my locker room there and get the troops fired.
Oh, man.
I think the McGinn camp is slightly conflicted about what kind of campaign they want. I mean, on one hand, you see an attempt to resuscitate him. So there's all positive ads, really, from his side. They're very, I mean, the most recent one is very McGinn. It's just McGinn. I mean, he's right there in the black, you know, background talking, I thought, pretty effectively about his record. But there's only so much you can do to rehab an image that people feel pretty sure about. You're an incumbent. There's not a lot you can do to change that. And he doesn't have high approval. So the other strategy is you try and take down the opponent. Well, they've kind of done that, but I would say they are very conflicted about that. I mean, there's no negative Ed Murray ad out there from the McGinn people. And when you see him debate, and especially in this Channel 9 debate, the most recent one, he tepidly walked into that. I mean, a little bit of criticism of Ed's time in Olympia, but didn't really... I mean, I was surprised at how non-aggressive the mayor was in this final campaign. He's been much more... In this final debate, he's been much more aggressive in some of the other debates that I've seen him in. And so I think they haven't quite decided whether they're going to be anti-Murray. That does get them into a trap of looking divisive, so there's a downside to going negative. And it seems to me they've settled on this third strategy, which is turnout. They basically feel like they probably can't do much to turn around his image. They probably can't do much to turn around Ed's image. What they need to do is get people who don't otherwise vote, especially the young, to the polls. They do not have to convince them for McGinn. He wins that demographic. The problem is they do not vote, especially in an off-year election. So they are phone banking like mad. They are doing what they can to get the people, especially the young under 35, to the polls. If they can do that in large numbers, that's how they win.
Being a contrarian, that's where I think there is some interest in that. In the anonymity of radio, and we'll announce our poll on the air here, pretend you're all Seattle voters, because I don't know who's who and who isn't. Mike McGinn? Ed Murray? Okay, well, in the unscientific poll of this KOW donor audience, imagine an Ed Murray regime 1 year from now. How's Ed Murray going to govern, and what's he going to move on?
Well, he's going to have about 25 summit meetings, lots of consultation. I mean, it's part of his campaign, but one of his answers to just about everything is, well, I'm going to convene a group of people to talk about that issue.
What do you think they do all day in Olympia?
Exactly. Let's caucus.
Well, maybe that's a good way to govern.
Well, yeah, you might say that that is a good way to govern, especially in Seattle, which we adore process. But I think there is a way that there are qualities that Ed Murray has as somebody who is deliberative and who is willing to listen to people on both sides of the issue that is of value. And I would be very surprised. I think it'll be very interesting if he's elected to see who he appoints in his administration. I think he's taking a kind of team of rivals approach. where he's gotten a lot of support from the guys who were running against him in the primary. And it'll be very interesting to see how he taps Bruce Harrell, Tim Burgess, Peter Steinbrück, and other people to create an administration that's more representative.
You don't think those guys would leave the council to join an administration, do you? Harrell or Burgess?
Probably not, but I wouldn't be surprised, and certainly Peter Steinbrück might be available.
Yeah, well, he's looking for work.
I think, ironically, you wouldn't see that big a difference, especially in the first couple years. I mean, they're both going to do pre-K, universal pre-K, and very likely a ballot measure next fall, so working on that. I think you very likely see both kind of work to some kind of living wage bill, maybe something you can get through the council, maybe something that goes on the ballot. I think they're both going to be convening a national search for a police chief. I think they're both going to be...
Actually, you think Mike McGinn will be in Greenwood thinking about what he's doing next. You think Ed Murray will be doing that. But continue.
Well, I mean, I think they'll both be doubling down on road maintenance. I think they'll both be dealing with coal trains. I mean, ironically, I don't see these agendas as being super different.
More or fewer bike lanes being constructed in a Murray administration. And more or fewer sidewalks.
Well, and one thing Murray has said is that he would, you know, create an integrated transportation plan. And that's something that you know... McGinn says we already have, but, you know, so presumably McGinn wouldn't be doing that. I mean, would you have more bike lanes under McGinn? I think probably yes.
Politicians work on what they know best is how I view this. And I think that, you know, Ed Murray was the chairman of the Transportation Committee for a very long time, also the Budget Committee. So I think Ed Murray would work specifically on transportation. I think if McGinn won, he'd be very active on the environment, very active fighting coal, that kind of thing. I think folks work in the neighborhood that they're comfortable in, the area that they know.
I think one point of contrast would be the Sonics Arena. I think McGinn is all in on making the arena happen. Of course, the city council, I mean, there's an agreement. There's an environmental impact statement in process. Murray has gotten the support of a lot of arena skeptics. People, and they're skeptics about the arena in Soto specifically. He's got a good relationship with the port. He, I think, is open to discussion about the larger ramifications to the industrial area and the economy of the arena, and looking at that in ways that I don't think McGinn has been as interested in. I think that's one point of difference, is you would see maybe a little bit more of a skeptical approach on the arena from Ed Murray. It would be full steam ahead by McGinn.
All right, we're looking at what's on the ballot. I don't know if we're going to get to all the other issues we talked about, but we'll try. Luke Burbank, Seattle's own Luke Burbank, host of TBTL, the podcast, often a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, also taking jobs from people who want to work for the CBS Sunday Morning News Magazine, has been joining us to talk about what he's been doing and what's happening on LiveWire, a show that he hosts that airs 8 o'clock on Fridays on KOW. Luke, have you been looking at the ballot?
You know, it's funny. I'm actually looking at the ballot as we speak. I'm standing in my kitchen. And, you know, I wasn't great about voting in the local elections over the, you know, past years, because I just thought, I don't know if I have time to drive down to the elementary school and talk to the nice senior citizens working there. I thought if they just did mail-in ballot, I would definitely start voting more. And I'm looking at this ballot and I'm thinking, I don't know if I have the time to fill this in and put this in the envelope and mail it. That is how apathetic I am about this race.
Well, there goes your political career.
You probably don't even have stamps in your house.
Walter, I'm putting the system on trial here. I don't think that this has to make it so that I can't have a political, just because I haven't voted in the last six elections.
Yeah.
Nobody will bring it up, I promise.
What if you would vote, and, you know, think about it, what is most intriguing to you?
Well, you know, Canute actually just sort of jogged my memory that, and this just shows you, what was it, Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. For me, the most important issue would be trying to get a basketball team back. And because McGinn is, as Canute said, all in on that one, I guess I would throw a vote his way, which shows you what a bad voter I am, that would be enough to make me vote for one person over the other.
Yeah, just whoever has the best free throw, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think that's going to go to McGinn.
Do you? You don't think Murray's got
basketball? He really does. He's into it.
Yeah, he is. And you know what? All elbows, as I've heard.
That's the word on the street. He definitely gets down there in the power zone and just does not let anybody else get in there.
Are you going to be You're not going to be taking this up on LiveWire tonight, because it's probably on tape, for one thing.
Yeah, that is the thing. Is we record the show on a Saturday night in Portland, and then we air it the following week. But this was a trying week for me because last Saturday I was flying up from L.A. to Portland to do the show, and my laptop got stolen. And this is the laptop that I write the whole show on. And so as I was flying to Portland, I had to rewrite the entire show on my iPhone.
Oh, there you go. And could you read the script?
At one point I asked one of the guests the first time they flapped a meatloaf football, which was just autocorrect. I thought I was having a stroke on stage. So it's not a great show this week. I don't want to overpromise. But we did have this guy on. Steve, have you heard of this movie, The Room, which has been awarded the title of like the worst film ever made? This rich guy in Los Angeles self-financed this film starring him and then ran it in a movie theater in L.A. for 2 weeks because that's what you have to do to be eligible for an Academy Award.
And now it's going to be nominated.
No, it is such a bad film that some people who saw it once brought their friends because they couldn't believe how horrible this movie The Room was, and then they continued to have more people come until it's now probably the most popular bad movie in America. So we have the co-star of the movie on the stage in Portland with us talking about it. And then we had the band Twin Forks, which is a cool group that plays some music. So aside from the fact that I rewrote the script on my iPhone, the show turned out okay.
All right, man. We'll listen to it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, you guys.
Luke Burbank has been joining us to say he's not voting. I think that's what I heard.
Always inspirational.
He's host of LiveWire at KOW tonight at 8. All right, I only left you guys 1 minute. Just for one, and I might want to take this up again later. You know, folks, we have a Week in Review Extra that runs on the record. You should tune in at in the 1 o'clock hour, if I'm not mistaken, and you can hear more of this. It's recorded magically after we turn off the mics here. Knut wrote a story about future monuments, and there was a whole list of interesting future monuments that might be designated in the city of Seattle. I wonder if each of you have a designation for something that in the future, what was the Kurt Cobain bench, the new building up on Capitol Hill? What's yours, CR?
I would add the Great Wheel on the waterfront, which wow. I was a skeptic of, and now I love.
I'm with you. Yours?
Sports stadiums that have been recycled. You know, because they get tired of them and that sort of thing. They move into them, they have a 2025, and then they make them monuments.
I see. That's going to keep Key Arena around.
Yeah. Well, my nominees were in the article in the Cool House Library, which an architecture critic predicted would be a pot grow site in 30 years.
But it makes
a great greenhouse.
But you didn't have dicks. And I think a dick should be up there, too. All right. C.R. Douglas, Knut Berger, Joni Balter, also Luke Burbank. Thanks for joining us on the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. And thank you, KUOW donor audience. Don't forget to tune in a few hours for the Week in Review Extra. This is KUOW.